Welcome to the 18th episode of La Storia podcast. I'm your host, Santina Giannino. Today's guest is Elizabeth Mullane, author of 60 Blades of Grass, a moving World War II drama based on true events.
Betsy. Good morning, Santina. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good.
I'm so glad you can make it here to Braintree.
Oh, I'm so pleased to be with you here today, Santina. Okay. Such a privilege.
Can't wait to hear your story, your background. Want to start with your background? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Absolutely. I was raised in Michigan, along the shores of Lake Michigan. A beautiful, beautiful place to live. But I went to Boston College. That's nice. What got me out on the East Coast.
Nice.
Yeah. And I just stayed.
You stayed. Yeah. Why'd you fall in love?
You know, actually... Actually, I first went to work for Jordan Marsh, of all places.
Oh, wow.
They're an old retail place that actually has morphed into, I believe, Macy's, Filene's and then Macy's.
Yes.
I did their retail training program, but that wasn't for me. So I started doing textbook sales for John Wiley, and that was terrific.
Oh, wow. Nice. Yeah. Nice. But you're a realtor now, so.
I am a realtor. I was a stay-at-home mom quite a few years. And when I got divorced, there wasn't a lot that a woman my age could do. There's a lot of age discrimination out there for older women. But I did find a sales job, but it wasn't enough. So having had a family who was involved in real estate, my grandfather, my mother, my father, my sister, my brother-in-law, they're all doing real estate. And I had heard about real estate from being a little kid. That's all that was talked about around the dinner table. Wow. So I feel I understand it, the ins and the outs. And actually, it's a pretty great gig for a middle-aged woman to do. Yeah.
Wow. How long you been doing that?
At least a dozen years. I was doing it for a while down in Connecticut, and then I moved up here to Boston to do it.
Nice, nice. And you live in Needham, so that's like your area?
I live in Needham. I do Metro West. But funny thing is, all of my business comes from referrals. So I go to where the referrals take me. But also, say first-time buyers who think that they can get into Needham, they're outbid often. Just, you know, for a first-time buyer, that's a tough gig to get. So I find them places in Dedham, Canton, Quincy, everywhere else.
Nice. But, well, yeah, I think we all have to do that, right? We go where the work is.
We do. And we go to where we can buy the house.
Exactly.
And I actually sent notes to my buyers this past year and just said, wow, did you ever make out well? Because the value on their houses have gone up so much. But also, the people who I sold houses to, they sold them at a very, very good price. I do about 50-50 listings and first-time buyers.
Oh, nice. That's pretty balanced, huh?
50-50. It is.
Yeah.
I actually feel that if you don't work with both sides of the table,
right,
you won't really understand. For example, as a seller, you really want to get your head around what the buyers are going to think about your house. Having worked with buyers, I understand how presentation, like your staging company, is everything. That first impression is essential. I also know the way that they're thinking. How far is the commute to Boston? Is there public transportation?
Right.
How, well, not that I can really address this because it's a matter of taste and it's very subjective, but the schools, are the schools what you want them to be?
Exactly. That's very important if you have a family. I mean,
exactly.
And that's what brings the prices up, right? In a lot of communities. Good school, high prices.
You know, my mother used to go talk to the public once a year when they would be raising the taxes on, you know, the community that I was from, North Muskegon, Michigan. And she always said, to maintain the value of your house, you need a good, strong school system.
Absolutely. Everybody looks for that. Exactly. Yeah, if they have a family. So here we are, you're a realtor, and
yes,
then you became an author. And I just finished reading your book last week. I loved it. Couldn't put it down.
Thank you.
It's just like, it's nice to pick up a book where you want to keep on going. Like, you want to know what's going to happen next. What's going to happen next. And that's how it was. It was just really great.
That was kind of by design. I wanted people to want to read to the next chapter. I think in real life it's not always like that. But my relatives were probably so full of fear all the time and were so brave all the time. Their life probably seemed like it was very close to being ended any moment. Mm-hmm. So their life was like that, I believe.
So what gave you the idea of writing a book? Because it's not a usual thing that everybody sits down and writes a book.
Well, I was an English major, so reader, and I've always loved books. Laura Ingalls Wilder was somebody I still read to this day. She's just fantastic. I think everybody has a story. I make up stories about the houses I go into or just see on the street, you know, what their tastes are like, what they're serving for dinner, you know, whether that teenage daughter is coming home with her date tonight, you know, somebody new to meet, whatever. I just paint stories like that. And this was such a compelling story to begin with. My family was active in the Dutch underground during World War II. And I heard their stories as a little kid. And then when I did a junior year abroad, I thought, well, I'd love to go visit them. And I did 3 times. I assumed they would take me on tours of Holland, and they did take me a few places. But most of all, they all congregated together to meet this granddaughter of Marie Pfeiffer Ouwerkerk, who was my grandmother, who had traveled over to America before the Second World War, indeed around the time of the First World War, to get married. They wanted to meet her granddaughter because after the war, she sent them many parcels that allowed them to survive the end of the war when everyone was starving. But back to what they were telling me, they would congregate together, and thank goodness their English was superb. It was impeccable, as all of them were. And they told me stories about how they had survived the Second World War, and I was just stunned by them. I tried to capture as many of them as I could when I returned to the States, but when you're 20 years old, you really don't realize what you've been given. And although I jotted them down and shared them with my brothers and sisters, they didn't really form themselves into a book until I started to talk about it and study World War II. I messed around with the book for a while. It wasn't until I went to a writer's conference that a voice came to me. The voice was my Aunt Ria, Rika, in the book, really telling me, reminding me about how she had eventually survived. I wrote that down. I don't think I've changed 50 words of it, and the book was started, but that's the last chapter. So you'd have to read more to find out how it happened.
Yeah. So Rika was your aunt. Did you meet her?
I did not meet her. She was in Paris as an artist to begin with.
Oh.
And I didn't go to Paris during those trips. But I also had an uncle who was essential to the underground because he would get the German secrets and pass them on to Queen Wilhelmina via wireless radio. Now, I was told all
that's of this. That's the father, right? That's Rika's father.
Yes. I wasn't told any of this directly by them. It was all what I'd been told by the relatives who had heard little snippets of their stories. So I put down what was true, but I also incorporated a lot of other firsthand accounts about how the Dutch underground worked and created characters around them.
Really fascinating. Like, I mean, she was only 17 years old.
She was.
To be involved in such a great thing. It's just kind of like 17 years old, like, how do you get involved with the underground?
I think she just felt she had to do something because she thought that the persecution of their Jewish countrymen was so awful. She didn't feel she could live without resisting it. So little pods of underground people gathered together, and they asked her, among other things. I heard later that she was did a lot of counterfeiting because of her skill with the pen and paper. She would go to the bombed out rail yard of Amsterdam. That's where they were transporting the Jews from. I believe it was once or twice a week. They would do a roundup. They would bring them all to the station, and they would load them onto the trains. Initially, the Dutch did not know where their beloved countrymen were being brought to. They were only told they were being relocated. So they said to her, take down as much information about the trains as you possibly can. Code them in your paintings of weeds or flowers or whatever you see. Certainly don't paint the actual trains.
Right.
Leave it under a piece of rubble. We'll collect all of this, and at the end of the war, we will be able to go and find our beloved countrymen. Wherever they might be, we'll retrace their steps.
Oh, I missed that part. So the information was for after the war to try and rescue them after.
Right. They didn't know about the death camps then. They didn't know how long the war would last. And actually, the war lasted in Holland longer than most of the countries in Europe. They were the last to be liberated. The Nazis really dug in deep in Holland. And after the Battle of Arnhem, only freed part of Holland, the Nazis just held on till the bitter end.
So the name of the book is 60 Blades of Grass.
That's right.
So what's the 60?
You'll have to read it.
I read it. Oh, okay.
Well, actually, though, 60 Blades of Grass, think of her painting in the rail yards, and there were grasses around, and perhaps one stem of grass would mean
one
20
person.
People.
Oh, one person. Okay, yeah. All right.
That's, 20 people, right. Yeah. So 60 blades, they'd be able to decode.
Right, exactly. And because I did read the book, so I knew that. I just want to give a little...
Thank you, and I appreciate that. I didn't come up with the title. I couldn't think of anything. This came from a fellow writer. It took me about 12 years from the beginning of the book to get it published. I wrote it in about 2, and I went to classes, and it was heavily critiqued by other authors and other students. And then I put it out in the world, and I was runner-up in a contest, and I thought, okay, my life is made. I'm sure an agent and a publisher will come knocking. Not so fast. After every rejection, and I continued to send it out to editors and to agents, after every rejection, I revised it because I thought I had the benefit of the top echelon of literary critics at my disposal if they did get back to me on their thoughts about the book. And I should incorporate what they thought might not be, what they needed from me. One thing that they needed was a bigger book. So I went back to the drawing board and added more chapters based on firsthand accounts from other people. And then another person said, I don't feel close enough to the protagonists. And I thought, that was puzzling to me because I was deeply in love with all of my characters.
Right.
But I thought, how do I make them feel closer? And I thought, well, a love life. And then I thought, don't even wait for them to bring this up. Just invent a sex life for all of them. So I did. But when I told my 92-year-old mother what it took to get published, because I got a publishing contract soon after I incorporated that, she said, how did it happen? I told her. I said I had to bring in a love life and a sex life for all of them. She said, well, you have to change the names. I said, well, why? She said, because we've got relatives in Holland, and they will be scandalized if they find out that you were speculating about all their love lives. You can't do that. So I went back to my publisher and agent. They said, okay, you can change the names. So Rhea became Rika. Alban became Maxim. Leishan became Lisbeth. And Hani became Amy.
Wow. That's amazing.
It really was. It's a dream come true. I get calls from book clubs saying, we read your book. Can you come and speak about it?
Right.
Happily to. I'm going to speak at the Providence Boston College University Club in a week or two. I'm speaking at North Hill. I've been at libraries and senior centers and bookstores. It's been really a terrific, terrific journey.
Yeah. I'm in a book club, and I told you I'm going to recommend this. I mean, we have the books for the next 2 months, and then we take the summer off. So,
but that makes sense.
Yeah.
But if you get to it,
so then that way you can come and talk to us, which is what we like to do. when I like the books, yeah.
That's
and it's so convenient to have you so close by, you know?
And it's fun to get the feedback. For example, somebody the other day in a book club said, you shift, the voice changes in this part of the book, and I understand why. I hadn't realized I'd really done it. I'd just written down what the character was telling me. And maybe I'm a little schizophrenic, but really, I listened to these voices. They all came to me. You have first person Rika, first person Maxim, first person Leishan, first person Amy. Those are the main characters, and those are the voices that you hear.
Right. And they're all interesting in their own way. And it's kind of like a mystery a little bit, because you don't know that they know that they're all doing the same thing.
Well, secrecy was their greatest protection.
To protect themselves. Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
Now, I don't know if, in fact, that was true for them. But I knew enough from my studies that secrecy was everything. So I thought it was very plausible that they might have kept their activity secret. I do know this. I stood in the closet where they hid the Jews. And you would think that the closet would be,
the actual closet in the book?
Yes.
The house? Wow.
Yeah, absolutely. You would think that the closet would be a walk-in closet with a cot and things like that. Not at all. This was a place that barely two adults could stand in. They couldn't sit down, really, at all. So they would stand there when there was a raid going on. They had to take tremendous precautions. Say the Nazis figured out or suspected them of harboring Jews. They would bust in during dinner time. Well, you wouldn't, say you had, there were two people in the household and you had two Jews staying with you. You wouldn't set the table for four Jews. You would only set it for two. So if the Germans busted in and the people had slid into the closet, had enough time to do that, they would see, only two places are set. You wouldn't allow them to have an open suitcase with only their clothes. Their clothes would be mingled with yours to make it look like only you were there.
Right.
You would be careful about flushing the toilet if you lived in an apartment, because your neighbor could hear the toilet flushing. And indeed, it happened in one of the books that I read where someone said, 16 flushes in, a certain time period, she's got to be hiding Jews. And they turned the woman in for it, and they caught the Jews that way, just listening to the toilet flushing.
Right.
So you had to be very careful. If you were sleeping at night, you would hear the Nazis, they would bang on the door, the Jews would fly into the hiding place. You would flip their mattress because they would make sure to touch to see where the mattresses were warm. And if there were four spots that were warm, where there should be two, they would know Jews would be hiding. And they would surround the house until the Jews came out.
Right. Wow. I mean, they all took their lives into their own hands, which is so heroic.
Was constant. The fear was constant. But the hunger was also very real.
Oh, yeah. It's the way that you describe it, too. I mean, I can actually feel it, They were all so hungry.
They were
all
hungry
the time.
All the time. Because the Germans gave food. My uncle had said, and I was told this by my relatives, watch out to see who's getting fat. Because whoever was gaining weight or maintaining their weight was getting food from the Germans for the information they were given the Germans.
Right. So you said that it took you 12 years to publish the book.
That's right.
That's a long time.
It is, but I'm perhaps the most persistent person you will ever know, but also it was a story I felt needed to be told. It was a story that it spoke about my family and what kind of people we are.
Yeah.
I might not feel that way today, and I often wonder, would I be able to resist such evil? I'm assured by other people I would be, of all people, ready to fight for anything. But it's just incredible to me that they did it. So I wanted it to come to light. Again, it's such a good story.
It is such a good story. So if somebody was thinking about writing a book, like what kind of steps do you take to, obviously it's a very big job to write the book itself. But once you're done, it seems like it's even a bigger job to get it published, right? Because it's three, four times the time that it took you to write it, to publish it. So how do you go about that?
You know, I started with an idea, but then I took a class by a published writer who really knew her stuff. So around a kitchen table, we were every other week with a chapter. You'd read it out loud, and you'd have to sit back and button your lip and listen to everyone critique it. All of a sudden, you started figuring out what they were going to say before they said it. So that was essential. That was such an education. Then I got brave enough to join a library group that was critiquing chapters that way. Then I just kept taking classes as I refined it. I just kept sending it out to agents and editors. I went to, initially this was going to be a young adult, or not a young adult, but a middle grade novel. So I went to SCBWI, this conference of children book writers. The hardest thing for me was to write the query. And from there, actually, a famous writer told me what to write for the query. So always bless her for that. A query is one paragraph, three or four sentences about what the book is about, is next to impossible to just put down on paper.
A book, yeah, and just in two, three sentences.
Right.
It's really, really hard. Yeah.
So I needed help there.
Yeah.
But after that, finally succeeded. And then, after I got the agent, it took him a couple of years to get it well placed.
Did you find the agent? The agent find you?
A little bit of both. But it's incredibly hard, no matter what.
Right.
So, and it, like I said, it took me years to do that. But I think he was willing to stick with me because I was willing to revise so much.
Yeah, you're open to,
yes,
to constructive criticism, which is right.
Exactly.
Even though it's your baby, you still have to, people have to read it, right?
Well,
and enjoy it.
I've heard too many stories about people who were told, you know, okay, I'll take this on if you just make these changes. They said, no, it's fine the way it is. I'll find someone else to publish it this way.
Yeah.
And then they never get published. Right. I really wanted to get published.
So now you're moving on to your next book, right?
Yes, I am. I come from a movable feast of wonderful stories about growing up in Michigan. Because everywhere you go, it's the strife and it's the conflict and it's the hard work that creates the movable feast. You know, and I had such great characters growing up. And I'd like to think that my brothers and sisters and I were great characters too. So it's capturing them that I'm hoping to do now.
So it's about the family again.
Yeah.
The American family this time.
the American family, exactly. Believe me, it wasn't like the Brady Bunch.
That's great. That's great. So when did you start this book?
I have been working on this book off and on for a couple of years now. That said, I do keep getting distracted by my business, but also the needs of 60 Blades of Grass to be promoted.
Right, right.
So I figure this is like getting a child into the world. And so I have about a year to get it out there. So I'm doing, you know, one big last push for it.
That's great. I was reading some of the reviews on Amazon, and I mean, they're all raving reviews, 5 stars, and people just really love it.
They have read it,
yeah.
They have been extremely complimentary.
Yeah.
I love it when people know me and they say, okay, I bought it because I know her. But I loved it because I loved the story. That really warms my heart.
Well, Christine told me about you in the book.
It's actually
her book. I haven't bought the book yet. So we traded books.
That's great. I'd love to see a dog-eared book. I'd love to see a well-loved book.
Yeah, yeah.
And I love it that people are sharing it.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, I gave her a book that I was reading that I really liked a lot. And she's like, and I have a book for you. And this is what, now here we are.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, it's Christine McIntyre.
Christine McIntyre.
Who is a sales coach. She is, she's phenomenal.
She's a good friend of mine, very good friend of mine.
She is just an amazing person.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I also have another fledgling business right now.
Like
which
what?
Is an outgrowth out of my real estate business. I realize, well, I've got a 92-year-old mother living in Michigan. She lives in the house that she loves. She's decorated it just the way she wants to. She knows her kitchen. She still bakes and cooks. She still irons the sheets for the beds and makes the beds. She's just phenomenal. And I want her to stay there as long as possible. If, though, my brothers didn't live nearby to help her out, say, when the house needs to be painted or the roof is leaking or the garden needs to be tended, I think she would have to go to assisted living. But because they do help her out and maintain the value of the house for her, everything works. But there are a lot of people out here whose children live on the West Coast or in the Midwest or down in Florida, and they can't manage the home repairs that they should. Mm-hmm. So I'm the person that you call to come in and say, okay, we're going to get you on a schedule of the furnace will be tuned up by this person on this date, because I've got all these wonderful contractors that I know and trust. And I can set this all up for people. If people need perhaps some help, you know, on their computer or getting their phones fixed or something like that, I'm the gal who can do it.
Wow. So you're a project manager.
It's called, yep, it's called Betsy's Concierge Home Home Maintenance. That's it. And I think that it works.
That's great.
That it helps everybody.
That's great. Yeah. I mean, there's people that I need of that type of thing, and it helps them, like you said, you know, stay independent. And
yes. As a matter of fact, I'm doing a talk on the April 11th at 11 at the Center at the Heights with a company that will come through and say, okay, you need a handhold here. You will need a banister here. You will need a little shelf here. Everything to make it easier to stay in the house and make your life there less dangerous.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
So you're always thinking.
Well, you gotta
progress,
be.
Progress.
Gotta be.
Yeah.
Like you. Always thinking.
We try. It keeps us interested in life, right?
Well,
otherwise you get bored.
and meeting fantastic people like you are.
Yeah.
I've met more people like yourself, Santina, who are unafraid, who can reimagine things for themselves, and who aren't threatened by other strong women that they encounter.
I love being around strong women. I mean, that's what keeps us going, really, right? And we all help each other. It's great. That's why I like networking, because every time I go, I meet somebody really interesting. And I mean, how would I be able to get 18 guests from my podcast? And it's just through people, talk to people, meet people like you. You know, we become friends and we like each other and we can have coffee and here we are.
Exactly.
Right?
And I want to help you do the same thing.
Exactly.
The house needs to be staged. You're the gal I'm going to call.
Thank you.
Because you get it. Here I am in your gorgeous house anyway. If anyone needs an advertisement for how well she can stage a house, she lives in one.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Yeah, so that's wonderful. I'm delighted that you can make it today. You have a really compelling story, and I hope everybody goes out there and buys 60 blades of grass. You won't regret it.
I would love that too, and I'd love to hear from you. I love it when people send me an email saying, what about this? Because I'm ElizabethMolina@gmail.com. Just write to me.
Excellent.
Anyway,
thank you so much, Betsy.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.